Evidence and Answers begins right now.
This is Evidence and Answers radio broadcast with our host, Pat Zukran. Pat is an author, teacher, and international speaker in the area of Christian apologetics, the defense of the Christian faith, from the stars in the heavens to the moral law written on our hearts. The Bible gives us compelling reasons to believe in God. In this episode, Dr. Zukran walks us through the apologetic arguments Jesus affirmed, from creation to conscience. It's a conversation that will deepen your faith and equip you to engage a questioning world. If you've missed any part of this broadcast, log on at evidenceandanswers.org, and there you will find this discussion entitled, Jesus' Use of Apologetics in the Arguments of God's Existence, show number 8 from Paratus, a podcast from Veritas International University. And you'll find hundreds more podcasts that you may download or listen online. Now let's get right into the conclusion of this fascinating discussion.
Well, let's get back to a more classic argument for God's existence, the teleological argument. So what is the teleological argument? And how did Jesus use the Old Testament to support this?
Yeah, the teleological argument is also known as the argument from design. You know, and basically the argument goes like this. Every design has a designer. The universe displays intelligent design. Therefore, there is an intelligent designer. And what we're learning as we advance in scientific technology, from the telescope to the microscope, we are seeing intelligent design everywhere, from the fundamental forces that hold the universe together to the structure of the human body, the brain, our solar system, to something as small as the nucleus of a cell, which we are learning is as complex as the city of New York. I mean, we are seeing intelligent design everywhere, and it just continues to grow as we advance in our scientific technology. And that's what the Old Testament states. Psalm 19 has been known as the Psalm of the Scientists. The psalmist writes, "The heavens declare the glory of God, and the firmament shows his handiwork. Day and night they pour forth his speech. Creation keeps pointing its finger to its creator." So as the psalmist says, the heavens declare the glory of God. The more you study creation around you, the more and more it's getting harder to deny there is a creator. Psalm 8, the psalmist writes, "When I consider your heavens, the work of your fingers, and the moon and stars which you have set in place," creation continues to point its finger to a creator. I remember going on a hike here in Hawaii with a professor of mathematics, you know, and as we were looking around, I said, "What do you see? What do you see around you?" And, you know, mathematicians, they're a different breed. He said, "Everywhere I see is mathematics. Mathematics is everywhere." And I looked, I said, "Don't you see the trees? Don't you see the mountains?" He said, "Well, look at the trees. It's all mathematics." I said, "What do you mean?" He goes, "Perfectly balanced here. If you have too many leaves on this side, the tree leans over. If it's not designed this way, you can't have water going up the tree." Just on and on. He says, "Look at the leaves. You know, look at their structure. They're balanced. It's mathematics." I mean, he was just pointing out mathematics everywhere. And I says, "That shows design, doesn't it?" And he said, "Yeah, for a mathematician, it's really hard to deny intelligent design here." Hmm. And so that's what the psalmist is saying. As you study creation around you, creation keeps pointing its finger to its creator.
Yeah, so good. You know, and I even think with some modern theoretical physicists, someone such as the Japanese American Dr. Kaku, you know, that's K-A-K-U for those who are wanting to look it up. A couple of years ago, he really came out and started to wrestle with this because he's essentially saying there is so much design, there is so much in the world that really points to a super intelligence that even these theoretical physicists are starting to, you know, the modern theoretical physicists are starting to come to the conclusion like, wow, again, I'm not saying he's a Christian, but what I am saying is that they are starting to see this design and elements, and they can't escape that. Going back to the cosmological argument, a first cause. Well, who created this design? And so the design and purpose in nature truly is an amazing argument. So that's perfect. Well, let's move to a next one. Again, really popularized in our modern era by the writer C.S. Lewis, and really done more from an apologetic standpoint by the philosopher Elton Trueblood. But they really both use the moral argument as one of the strongest cases for the existence of God. So, Pat, what exactly is the moral argument? And then how would have Jesus used the Old Testament to explain this moral argument?
Yeah, basically the moral argument says that there is a universal moral law which all people abide by. And you can't have a universal moral law without a moral lawgiver. As you and I, you know, go around the world, we see that all cultures, you know, we all have this sense of right and wrong. And the moral law is similar in cultures all over the world. Stealing is wrong in every culture. Rape is wrong in every culture. Adultery is wrong in every culture. No culture honors the coward who runs away in battle. In every culture, there's this innate sense of right and wrong, and a universal moral law points to a moral lawgiver. And so within us, because we're created in the image of God, that moral law is embedded within us, you know, in our conscience. We know right from wrong. Even children, as I watch my boy and little kids play, you always hear, it's not fair, it's not fair. Well, where'd they get that sense from, you know, that sense of justice? Well, when we see tremendous injustice, for example, when, you know, you see a murderer get away with a crime, they're in the news. Oh, man, you see protests on the streets. We have that innate sense of right and wrong. It's within all of us. And that's why God in the Old Testament holds nations accountable. They may not have the revelation of the Word of God, but they have that moral conscience, that sense of right and wrong. And that's why God holds them accountable and judges them. You know, a good case we brought up in the book is, you know, Leviticus 18. God condemns and judges the Canaanites. And he condemns them for their immoral practices of sodomy, bestiality, child sacrifice, temple prostitution, and all kinds of other forms of immorality. And God warns Israel. He says, do not defile yourselves with any of these things, for by all these the nations are defiled, which I'm casting out before you, for the land is defiled. Therefore, I visit the punishment of its iniquity upon it, and the land vomits out its inhabitants there in Leviticus 18. So the moral law is written on the hearts of all people. That's why the Canaanites, they may not have had the specific revelation of God, but they were morally accountable because that moral law is within all of us.
It is such an important argument for, you know, God's existence, and so much so that I forgot what year it was, but I think it was probably 5 or so years ago that Oxford University did a broad study to kind of put this to the test. And if I remember, it was their School of Anthropology, and they analyzed the ethnographic words and cultures from, you know, 60 different societies around the world, and determined, at least from their study, that there were 7 moral rules that have universal recognition across the world. So though, and most of them are found in the Ten Commandments, as we've pointed out, but that moral code is written in our psyche, in our person. And of course, it goes back to, well, where did that come from? Again, that cosmological argument, the first cause, the necessary moral lawgiver. So great argument. Okay, let's move to the next argument. Pat, again, another one that I felt, you know, along with your worship, I thought this one was a really good one, and particularly applicable to today's world, because it seems like we live in a world of existential angst, where we just don't know who we are. We're wandering around kind of aimlessly in society, and I'm talking about that in the broader culture. So you talk about this existential argument for God. So first of all, what is this, and again, how does the Old Testament uphold it?
Yes, the existential argument for the existence of God basically goes like this, you know, whatever human beings really need, not necessarily want, but really need, really exists. Okay? Human beings really need God. Therefore, God really exists. All right. So it's whatever we really need, not whatever we really want. For example, I really need water. And if there's a real, you know, strong need there, there's probably a reality behind that powerful need there. And so we see within all human beings, even the atheists like Nietzsche, you know, he cried out for God in the end. He ended up believing or espousing that God is dead, but he realized that in the death of God, or supposedly in the belief of atheism, if you kill God, eventually you kill man, and our need for meaning, a basis for morality, all that is gone that Nietzsche discovered there. So actually, if you understand, you know, Friedrich Nietzsche or Nietzsche correctly, what he espoused really is true. If there is no God, then our ultimate sense of meaning, our basis for morality, hope, all that disappears. And Nietzsche, Bertrand Russell, Richard Dawkins, and others, they're repeating what atheists have been saying for the last three centuries. But, you know, Solomon said that over 1,000 years ago, nearly two millennia ago, in Ecclesiastes chapter 1. He opens by saying, meaningless, meaningless, says the preacher, all is meaningless. What did he mean by that? Well, here at the end of his life, after he indulged in all the pleasures he wanted, women, wine, you know, wine, women, and song, money, gold, in the end, after turning away from God, he realized that it's all vanity or meaningless. Life without God, life without, you know, eternity is ultimately meaningless. And so that's the existential need for God, that when we turn away from God, we discover really life is all meaningless. It cannot fulfill us. C.S. Lewis, as you know, you previously mentioned, Brian, you know, wrote, I believe in mere Christianity. He said, if I find in myself desires which nothing in this world can satisfy, the only logical explanation is that I was made for another world. There's something greater beyond us that we were meant for.
So good. So good. Well, we've covered, I think, most of the major arguments for God's existence, particularly gleaning how the Old Testament would fortify them and uphold them. But Pat, briefly talk about how the New Testament authors picked up on these similar themes, the cosmological argument, the anthropological argument, the argument for worship and the moral argument, and how they use them in the New Testament. And you don't have to go over all the arguments, but maybe just touch on the cosmological argument or teleological or the moral argument, and just address how the New Testament authors kept these themes alive and well in the New Testament.
Yeah, you know, I remember when we were writing this chapter, you know, Dr. Geisler challenged me, and he said, yes, you might think Jesus is an evidentialist if you just stay in the Gospels. But if you go to the Old Testament, you'll discover, you know, the Old Testament, which he inspired, the prophets inspired by the Spirit of God or the Spirit of Christ gave these arguments. And then he said, if you look at the rest of the New Testament, the apostles who were inspired by the Spirit of Christ or God's Holy Spirit, made great arguments to establish the Christian worldview. And in Acts chapter 17, this is the second mission trip of Paul. Many consider this the first mission trip, actually, because Paul now goes outside the Jewish context and starts engaging the pagan world there. And he comes to the Areopagus, the great center of learning there at Athens, the great university there. And he runs into two groups of philosophers, the Epicureans and the Stoics, Acts 17 says. Now, the Epicureans were naturalists and the Stoics were pantheists. And so there on Mars Hill, you see a clash of all the three major worldviews there. Paul, who is a theist, the Epicureans, who are naturalists, and the Stoics, who are pantheists. And so now Paul, in that context, the Epicureans and Stoics don't have an Old Testament background. How indeed does he establish his case to present the gospel? Well, he first gives a form of the cosmological and theological argument there in Acts 17. He opens, not by quoting, you know, scriptures, but he opens by saying, the God who made the world and everything in it, being Lord of heaven and earth, does not live in the temples made by man. There he opens, establishing the theistic or Christian worldview that there is a personal God who created the universe out of nothing and designed everything in it. And from there, he goes on to quote the Greek poets. He says, we are his offspring, as your poets have said. And he quotes the Greek poets there, establishing that there is a God who created all things, who created us. And after he establishes the theistic worldview, then he presents his case for the gospel there. And so you can see in Paul's presentation, Acts 14, Acts 17, as he is now engaging the pagan world, he is giving arguments to establish first the Christian worldview before he presents the gospel. You know, and in Romans 1, writing to the Romans there, by this time the church had become largely Gentile and was in the Gentile world. He opens chapter 1 saying, the wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and unrighteousness of men who by their unrighteousness suppress the truth. And then he says in verse 19, for what can be known about God is plain to them. The things about God is plain to all people because he has shown it to them. Well, how? Well, then he tells you in verse 20, for his invisible attributes, namely his eternal power and divine nature, have been clearly perceived ever since the creation of the world in the things that have been made, so that all are without excuse. So there is the design argument there, that all people may know God, not just that a God exists, but certain attributes of God can be discovered just by the study of his creation there. And so that's why Paul says all men are without excuse. We've got the witness of creation, Romans chapter 2, the law of God written upon their heart of the conscience. And so you can see how the New Testament writers use arguments for the existence of God as they go in and lays the foundation for their presentation of the gospel.
So good. Yeah. So the New Testament authors are truly echoing, reflecting, if you will, what the Old Testament establishes. And though they're not classic syllogisms, like we said, you know, at the beginning, that because the biblical authors, they presupposed the existence of God, but they also were defending God's existence in the culture and day in which they live. So good, Pat. Well, we're at the time where we get to now talk about books. And many of our listening audience would say, okay, Pat, you have given us a lot of information to think about, and particularly for those listeners who may not fully understand all the classical arguments for God's existence. Let me just start by asking, what books would you recommend to introduce people to these classical apologetic arguments?
Yes, you know, of course, Dr. Geisler's great book that he co-authored with Frank Turek, I Don't Have Enough Faith to Be an Atheist, gives at a popular level these arguments for the existence of God. If you want a little more advanced book, one of the best out there, of course, is Dr. William Lane Craig. He did his PhD on the cosmological argument. So his material, his classic book, Reasonable Faith, is a great explanation of some of these arguments for the existence of God, especially the cosmological argument. And the moral argument, of course, is the classic C.S. Lewis, you know, Mere Christianity. There's a great case where he really expounds upon the moral argument there. And, you know, in a recent conversation I had with Dr. Oz Guinness, if you're not familiar with him, he's one of the premier Christian statesmen of our time. And I remember talking with him and I said, man, you are the reincarnation of C.S. Lewis. I never believed in reincarnation until I met you. You know, and he kind of chuckled and I said, how come you're always giving the moral argument? And he said, well, he said, that's the unbeatable argument. So really, what C.S. Lewis lays out in his book, it's really a powerful argument.
Yeah.
So those are some books I recommend.
Yeah, let me kind of piggyback on that. Elton Trueblood, who I mentioned earlier in the broadcast, in his Philosophy of Religion, that's the name of the book, he also expands on the moral argument, which is also very good. If you got Elton Trueblood and C.S. Lewis's books together in tandem and read them, you would really have a good, strong case. I also think, for me, back in the day where I cut some of my teeth on the classical apologetics was R.C. Sproul's book, I think with John Gerstner, Classical Apologetics, where they lay out each of the classic, the cosmological, teleological, and so on and so forth. I also am very appreciative, Pat, of Peter Kreef's book, Handbook of Christian Apologetics, which is also very excellent, and he lays out the classical arguments as well. And what's interesting about Kreeft, he's written a new book on truth, beauty, and goodness, which are the philosophical transcendentals. And in that book, he also lays out some other unique elements of arguments for God's existence in that. And then I know from my standpoint, my mentor, John Warwick Montgomery, you know, defending the faith in the messy world. And though it's not truly classical apologetics, it's more evidential apologetics, but it still is a great introduction for our listeners who want to get more into apologetics. And again, we need to underscore the importance of why we're dedicating so much time and energy to apologetics, because the world has amazing questions. And the world is wondering about a lot of things. And the beautiful thing is that Christianity has amazing answers. It has the answer, Jesus Christ, but it has answers to these huge questions. And some of these men that Pat has mentioned and I have mentioned, they've spent their life dedicated to unpacking and trying to explain these arguments so people could understand them. So be it Norman Geisler, be it C.S. Lewis, Peter Kreef, John Warwick Montgomery, go out and start learning more about this. And so, Pat, of course, we have to say that your book, The Apologetics of Jesus, which is the foundation for this series, is also another book that people could pick up and use to understand some of these classical arguments, as well as Dr. Holden's book, Living Loud, and the Harvest Handbook of Apologetics. All of these will deal with the classical apologetics that we think our listeners should know. So, Pat, thanks so much for being on the radio with us today.
Yes, thanks again. Always good to be with you, Brian.
Well, Pat, I appreciate it immensely. And join us next week as we look at Jesus's alleged anti-apologetic methods. That's sure to be an interesting topic. Until then, may the Lord richly bless you.
Our time today has come to a close. Be sure to join us again here on Evidence and Answers. Our goal is to bring you the love of Christ and to equip you in your faith to always be ready to give a response. If you would like to hold an apologetics conference or series of teachings at your facility, Contact Pat by calling him in Hawaii. That number there is 483-0586. Or email him through the Evidence and Answers website. That's evidenceandanswers.org. Be sure to browse through our listing of topics on our site. We have everything from atheism to Zen Buddhism. You will also find articles and additional audio for you to listen to or download. An additional location to find Pat's messages is on YouTube. Look up Evidence and Answers and hit that subscribe button. To keep quality broadcasts like Pat's on the air, we rely on generous financial support from you, our listeners. Donating is simple. Once again, log on at evidenceandanswers.org. Evidence and Answers is grateful for one of our sponsors, the Honolulu Christian Church. If you don't have a home church and are looking for a great place to grow in your faith, check out the Honolulu Christian Church. For service times, log in at honoluluchristian.org. Join us again next time on the air or online as we provide compelling reasons for faith in Christ. That's Evidence and Answers with Pat Zukeran.